Hello everyone, this is Lord Ping, and you're listening to Guildcast, the number one source for everything Guild Wars.
Why do we fight over stupid things like settling now? Why don't we just think about what this song's all about? Why does this all matter? There's too much worse things in the world today. Let's get along, let's have some fun, that's all that matters.
Hey everyone, welcome back to this 59th episode of Guildcast for December 23rd, 2006. I'm your host, Sean. In this week's episode, we're going to talk all about a little something you may already know about, but not really fully understand yet, and that's the Kurziks and the Luxans. If you have Chapter 2 factions, and you've played through the storyline, and you've seen some mention of both the Kurziks and the Luxans, but you aren't quite sure who they actually are, then this is the episode for you. Now, if you don't have factions, or the cultural storyline behind the Kurziks-Luxans struggle doesn't really interest you at all, then you can pretty much skip ahead to later parts of this episode. I'll talk a little bit about alliance battles in the PvP segment, and some preferred AB builds in the skills and builds segment. Also, at the end of the show, I have some pretty major announcements to make regarding the future of Guildcast, so be sure to listen to that at least. So, some people who asked to be mentioned this week include Silver Akrama and My Blade is Sharp, and I also wanted to make a quick shout-out to Doombox and the other people on the forums who have come up with the idea for this week's episode. Many times I forget who actually had the idea for an episode, or I forget to write it down, especially if someone gives me the idea in-game while I'm in the middle of playing something, but do know that I do appreciate the show topic suggestions, and if I use one that you've suggested and I don't mention you, it's certainly not done on purpose. Now, as for game updates, hoo boy, there's been a lot of them the last 2 weeks, so I'll just paraphrase a little bit and I'll point out the most important ones. First off, going back to December 13th, they basically heeded the complaints of so many Guild Wars players and they made the Domain of Anguish easier. They reduced the number of gems needed for the Embrace of Truth from 25 to 15 of each type, as well as increasing the gemstone's drop rate. They also increased the quality of some of the rewards produced by opening a Coffer of Whispers. And then on December 15th, the biggest thing that happened was a short-lived glitch that made Lion's Arch look like Amnoon Oasis, which was pretty interesting. Now, since I'm a big fan of glitches, and especially graphic glitches, I'm going to post some of the pictures that were sent to me in the glitch folder on the Guildcast photo gallery. You can access that from the main guildcast.com page. Now, these photos were sent to me by Nurum Valdramore, who was kind enough to send them to me because I was actually on vacation when this happened. So then, on the glorious day of glorious days, on December 20th, we had some wonderful new game improvements, as well as the introduction of Winter's Day 2006. So, let's just start out with Winter's Day. It's basically the same thing as last year. If you were here for the 2005 Winter's Day, you'll notice a lot of similarities. But this is basically the 2006 version of the annual competition of Duenna fighting for a mild winter and early spring versus Grenth, who's fighting for a long and cold winter. The event lasts for 13 days. It started on Wednesday, December 20th, 2006, at 4:25 Pacific Standard Time, and the grand finale on Winter's Day itself will be Monday, January 1st, and that will end at 11:59 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And the cities that are decorated right now for Winter's Day are Ascalon City, Lion's Arch, Drachner's Forge, and Commandon. Interestingly enough, they didn't decorate anything in Kanta. I don't know why, but during the festivities, there will be special quests that you'll be able to do. Two of the quests were from last year, the Greatest Snowman Ever Made, which supports Duenna, and then A Very Grinchy Winter's Day, which supports Grenth. And then there's two all-new quest chains revolving around the two competing holiday gods, featuring polar bears, reindeer, and devious presents. The quest Save the Reindeer can be acquired from Grandfather Kringle in Commandon. The quests following this quest are Find the Stolen Presents and Spreading the Winter's Day Spirit. The quest White Mist can be acquired from Elder Scrooge, that's S-K-R-U-U-J, in Commodon. The quests following this quest are How the Grinches Stole Winter's Day and The Gift of Giving. Then they also brought back the Snowball Fight arenas, but this time they introduced a new way of doing it with a PvE version. Now, the PvP version is still where you unite in an arena to fight for either Grenth or Duenna against other players. And then the first team to gather 5 presents for its patron deity will win the day. And then the new PvE version says, you venture into the underworld for a series of repeatable snowball fights against either the forces of Grenth or the forces of Duenna. Take control of piles of presents to ensure your side's victory in this frosty fray. Then they also brought back the Present Hunt, which is a repeat of last year's Present Hunt also. It basically works like this, where periodically a present spawns somewhere in the decorated towns, those 4 decorated towns that I listed. Players must spot the present, pick it up quickly, and deliver it to one of the young children in town before any of the Grenches manage to touch the present, which would destroy it. In return, the child will hand the player a random winter gift. And then there's the Wintergreen Challenge, which is new this year. It's hosted by the Zunle Guild. It revolves around the Wintergreen Tournament also. And what happens is contestants win Wintergreen weapons for correctly predicting the outcome of tournament games, and they may claim their reward from a Zunle Tournament agent. Also with the Winter's Day game update, various types of treasures, which are unlocked chests with a one-time use per character, appeared around Alona. And also a number of collectors have shown up in those same decorated towns, handing out special reward items in return for special collectible items. The selection differs depending on whether the collector supports Duenna or Grenth. And another new thing that they just introduced is the Festival Hat Maker, which appeared in Commodon and Lion's Arch only. Now what they're able to do is actually copy a festival hat. And this is an account-wide thing, so that if you have one character who has, say, the pumpkin crown, then you can go to this festival hat maker, and he'll copy one for another character on the same account. Now, this is the thing that Gail Gray was talking about a while back, where she said that there would be a new service that was meant to reduce the amount of storage and inventory space occupied by festival hats. Well, that's what this is. It's basically so that every character doesn't have to have a space allocated to a festival hat. You can have one character hold all the hats and then just copy them like that from now on. And then they also have a Winter Dwarf in Commodon, which is, it seems to be stirring a lot of people up. It's kind of funny, but it's a level 10 dwarf, and it's held by the Dwarf Guard. What you do is you talk to the Winter Dwarf, and it'll present 3 dialogue options. He'll actually die when a player selects the 3rd response. And that's about it. Nobody really understands what else he's supposed to be doing yet. But I'm sure we'll find out later on as Winter's Day progresses. And they've also brought back the Enchanted Snowman, which is basically a henchman that's an elementalist that you can add to your party. And they're all the same. They all look the same. And there's everywhere I've seen so far, it looks like they're in every town. I'm not sure if they're in every single town, but they're at least in a lot of the major towns, especially in Alona. Now, as far as items for Winter's Day 2006, I'll go over them really quickly and just give a brief description of each one. There's a Winter's Gift, which I mentioned, which you unwrap it and you find out what's inside, which could be any of these other gifts inside of the gift. There's a Snowman Summoner, which basically summons a snowman. Then there's eggnog, which is just basically, the holiday drink. And then there's spiked eggnog, which is a little bit more potent version of the regular eggnog. Then they have the Winter's Green Candy Cane, which is a new version of the old candy cane that we got last year. And they've actually renamed the old one into a peppermint candy cane. So the old one removes all death penalty from a character. And the new Wintergreen one removes only 15% of death penalty. And this is for PvE only. You can't use these for PvP. Then they have a Rainbow Candy Cane, which is basically a different flavor of candy cane. They have a Yuletide Tonic, which is, it says it, you drink this tonic if you want to be one of Duena's little helpers during the festivities. Then they have a frozen glob of ectoplasm, which says you'll need some of this collectible item when you get low on Yuletide tonic. Then, of course, they brought back the old candy cane shard, which you will want to save for Winter's Day itself on January 1st, because supposedly, like last year, they had where you save the shards and then they make weapons for you. That's where you got the, there was like a candy cane sword and wand and all that, you know, a bow and all that. Supposedly, they're going to do that again this year. And the places you can find a candy cane shard are either at the end of quests, the Winter's Day quests, victory in the Snowball PvP arenas. There's some that could be hidden in the Winter Gifts. And some of them just drop as random loot drops. And we also have a fruit cake, which is a tasty holiday staple that's sure to put a little spring in your step. Basically, it causes the sugar rush that a few other items can cause in the game. And that's in town only that it does that. And then, of course, on Winter's Day itself, we're supposed to have the headgear. And it's not really clear what we're going to have yet, but I'm pretty excited to find out what it is. I hope it's something new and exciting. Okay, so now this Winter's Day stuff is out of the way. And like I said, I'm going to talk more about this next week because I'll be able to find out a little bit more information. And also, after Winter's Day itself happens, I'll be able to talk about that too. So, other than Winter's Day, they also have the Party Search feature, which I absolutely love. It's basically, it's a panel that allows you to advertise when you're looking for a group to join, and to search for other players and parties to join you. With the Party Search panel, you can join up with other players even when they're in a different district from you. In any town or outpost, press P to bring up the new party search panel. If you're the leader of your party, or you're not in a party, which is treated as a party of one, you can use the Seek Party checkbox to add your group to the list of available players and parties, and also to advertise what you're looking for. So as a party leader, you can select another group and click Join to propose merging with that group. After clicking Join, you will see a question mark icon next to that group indicating that you are waiting for a response from them, and they will see an icon next to your group indicating that you have invited them. If you receive an invitation from another group, you can select that group and click Join to accept the invitation, merging the two groups. If you accept an invitation to join a group which is currently in a different district from you, your group will automatically travel to that other district. And of course, if you're alone, you will travel immediately upon clicking Join. If you have other people traveling with you, the game will provide a 10-second countdown and give each player the option of canceling. Now, this party search panel also has the added benefit of letting buyers and sellers advertise their wares in a more easily searchable and organized manner. You can scroll down the list to see what people are offering for sale or what they might be seeking, instead of the old way of just wading through oceans of spam in the trade or local chat channels. Now this, I believe, is a clever alternative to the much-demanded auction house. And another big feature they introduced during this update is the reconnect after disconnect. While playing in a mission, explorable area, or PvP game, if your game client loses its connection to the Guild Wars game servers due to internet connectivity issues, or if the game client or your computer crashes, you will have the opportunity to reconnect to the game servers and resume exactly where you left off, for a period of 10 minutes after the disconnection. Now, during that 10-minute period, your character will remain in the world. If your character was performing an action, like an attack or casting a spell at the exact moment of disconnection, then your character will actually complete that action. If your character was in a party, the other members of your party will be notified of the disconnection. You must reconnect from the same computer that you were playing on when the connection was lost. I've discovered also that this not only works when you're in a group with regular people, you know, human players, but also in an all-hero henchy group as well. Now, something else they introduced was new titles with this update. The new Commander title is available to players who compete in Hero Battles. Players receive 1 point toward the Commander title for each victory. The new Gamer title track is available to players who compete in Snowball Fights and other holiday-themed games. During the Winter's Day Festival, players who compete in Snowball Fights receive 10 points for each victory. Now, this has actually been changed on the December 21st update, where they max it out at 5 points, not 10. Also, some other updates include characters that come to Alola from a foreign land now get heroes that start at level 15, and they can play two new quests called Securing Champion's Dawn and A Land of Heroes. They didn't used to do this. It used to be a lot easier where you bring your characters over, say from Tyria, and you do a couple really small quests, and then you'd get to go right to the consulate docks and you'd be able to go to, you know, the mainland of Alola. Well, I think since they made the heroes now at level 15, where they used to be, you know, like level 2 and level 3, they want to make it a little bit more of a challenge to get to the consulate docks and then get to the mainland of Alola. So they added these two new quests. And I just discovered that this morning, because I wish I would have brought all my characters over earlier, but I actually had, I think I have two more left to bring over. And so I'll have to do all these other quests too. They also added six additional quests to Istin, and many existing quests have also been updated. The PvP Equipment Builder now allows a player to specify the dye color of weapons and offhand items. And also, Heroes Ascent now requires parties with a minimum of 4 human players. So I guess that's the end of Hero Way and Henchway. A new icon in the lower right-hand side of the screen has been added. If you notice a little green dot or orange dot, when you hover your mouse over that icon, it gives you the frames per second rate, the ping rate, and the server IP information. I've noticed that when the little icon is green, it usually means that you're doing okay with the ping rate and the FPS rate. But when you get to when it turns orange, I think that's when you're starting to approach a lag condition. And also, loading screens have an IP in the upper left-hand corner that shows you what server you're being connected to. And this is to help ArenaNet support resolve player issues. So then, finally, on Thursday, December 21st, the latest update, they removed the purpose column from the party search panel and added collapsible purpose groups instead. They added a new guild purpose to the party search also. They added an option to filter out other language districts from the party search panel. And this is only available in Europe. They re-enabled control clicking on the skill bar in outposts. This was actually inadvertently disabled in a previous build. And finally, they fixed a bug that caused guild information and unlocked hero skills to disappear when reconnecting after a disconnect. Now, before I start this segment on the Kurzix and Luxons, let me just say that while I try to be sure not to include any major Chapter 2 storyline spoilers, a few are still in there, so be aware of that if it's a concern of yours. The Kurzix are one of two vassal nations of Kanta, with the other one being their archenemy, the Luxons. These two vassal factions enjoy a great deal of autonomy under the umbrella of the Kantan Empire. The Kurzix settle in the Ekavald Forest, carving their homes and buildings in the trunks of giant petrified trees. This is used to represent their sturdy, non-swaying beliefs and solid cultural structure, which is very opposite of their enemies, the Luxons. Their capital is the city of Haus zu Helzer, located in the middle of the Ekavald Forest. The spiritual center of the nation is the Cathedral zu Helzer, located in the Arborstone area. The Kurzix are a spiritual people who see signs in everything around them. Divination and foreseeing the future have a prominent place in their culture. According to their own words, they respect innovation and creation above all else. Their society is a church state governed by the Council of Nobles, who stipulate laws and make decisions based on the guidance of their spiritual leaders, the Redemptors. Furthermore, there are the five great houses, which are noble families with great influence on the Kurzic nation, with lineages that can be traced to the earliest history of Kantha and beyond. The fact that the Kurzics are a nation of their own, with a culture separate from both the Kanthans and the Luxans, becomes very clear because of their distinctive look and language, which is very different from the typical Asian-inspired Kanthan theme. Their look can be described as Gothic, wearing quaint robes, suits, and hairstyles. Their preferred colors are gray and purple. Kurzic names are inspired by European rather than Asian languages, using typical names, words, and phonetics from Germanic and Slavic languages. Nowadays, the Kurzics are locked in continuous feud with their archenemy, the Luxans. This conflict goes back two centuries to the death of Emperor Anxion, who was actually the first to forge a peace treaty between the warring factions. For the first time, Luxans and Kurzics were at peace with this emperor in power. Kanthans everywhere celebrated the success of the emperor's negotiations, until Shiro Tagachi assassinated the emperor. The assassination was part of a dark ritual that was supposed to grant Shiro extraordinary power. The assassination succeeded, but Shiro was slain before the ritual could be completed. Upon his death, Shiro's soul unleashed the ritual's power, detonating waves of magical energy for miles in every direction. At sea, a violent storm created waves hundreds of feet high, battering Luxan ships into tinder. On land, a deadly wind blasted across plains and through forests, hammering Kurzic caravans along the way. This shockwave nearly killed the land of Kantha, until the storm stopped as suddenly as it began. On that day, the waters of the ocean froze in place and the Ekavald forest fell silent after tens of thousands of innocents had been slaughtered. The death of the 26th emperor changed Kantha forever. The Luxans had made their fortune through maritime trade, but a frozen sea brought their fleets to a standstill. The Kurzics had survived by hauling goods across the land, until the powerful creatures that once protected the forest turned on those who lived within it. The Luxans and Kurzics searched for new ways to survive, and they found them. Fixed within the frozen sea and hidden within the deadly forests, stockpiles of rare amber and jadeite waited for those brave enough to recover them. Desperation led to greed as Kurzic houses and Luxan clans warred for vast stretches of valuable land. Shiro Tagachi was brought to justice by the joined forces of the Kurzic champion, Saint Victor, and the Luxan champion, Archimorus. Unfortunately, both of them were killed by the Jade Wind, and the Kurzics and Luxans got into a fight over the circumstances of that event, both claiming the laurels for their people, which eventually sparked the war between them. Right after the war began, the two sides also separated their habitats, the Kurzic entrenched in the Ekavald, while the Luxans settled in the Jade Sea area. Locations along the borderline between these regions, such as Fort Aspenwood, the Jade Quarry, or the Harvest Temple in the Unwaking Waters, are fiercely fought over until present day. So now let's go a little bit more into the Luxans. The Luxans have always been a nomadic seafaring people. Since the Jade Wind turned the waters of the Jade Sea into solid jade, the Luxans have learned to take advantage of the situation and specialized in mining the solid sea for treasures. Their ships are now no more driven by the wind, but pulled by giant turtles. Even after the event, they stuck to their nomadic lifestyle, living in tents and light huts that can easily be moved to settle in a new location. Their capital is the city of Cavalon, located in the middle of the Jade Sea Bay. The culture seems to be related to that of ancient Greece, having taken on much of the nomenclature and nautical sensibilities of the Greeks. The time period of this would most likely correlate to the Dark Ages of the Greeks, the time during which the Dorians decimated Greek civilization. That's thought to be the basis behind ArenaNet's idea of the Luxans. The Luxans split up into three large clans, the Serpent, the Turtle, and the Crab. These clans often clash in skirmishes to demonstrate their power, for the Luxans respect strength above all else. Such skirmishes take place between champions on opposing sides accompanied by their elite guards. Despite the competition among the clans, they are still united as one nation in their war against their common foe, which are the Kurzaks, and they're still governed by a common council, the Council of Elders. Unlike their foes, the Kurzaks, who live in the cool shade of the Ekvald Forest, the Luxans are exposed to the strong sun and winds of the Canton Sea. As protection against these elements, they wear distinctively draped clothing. Now, a reference in the strategy guide for Guild Wars factions mentions that there is evidence that the Luxans of Cantha made it to the Crystal Desert. Since the Luxans were seafaring people, as were the Marganites, it may be possible that the Marganites and Luxans are the same people, or share a common ancestry. The only in-game evidence of this is a pile of bleached bones in the arid sea, with a journal entry comparing what is presumably a sandworm to a kraken. Today, the benevolent Emperor Kaisu rules over Cantha. The Luxans and Kurzaks remember the bloodshed of the last two centuries, and they still ceaselessly contest for land and power. The Emperor cannot stop their continual conflict. In fact, he knows that as long as the two factions remain at war with each other, that no one will be strong enough to rise up against him. He also knows that as long as they are eternally ready for war, they will be prepared to defend his land against more sinister threats. Luxans and Kurzaks are both still Cantons, after all, eternally watchful for evil in their midst, including malefic forces as dangerous as the infamous Shiro Tagachi.
Why can't we just put aside all the doubts about music and what has come?
Like I mentioned earlier, in this PvP segment, I'm going to talk about the meat and potatoes of the Kurzak-Luxan struggle, and that's the alliance battles. I know I've talked about alliance battles before here and there, and some of this will be review, but this time I'm going to go a little bit more in depth, and I'll talk a little bit more about up-to-date issues with the alliance battles. Alliance battles are 12 versus 12 PvP battles that control the border between the Kurzaks and the Luxans. Kurzaks wear their traditional blue color and appear as blue dots on the map, while Luxans wear their traditional red color and appear as red dots on the map. There are 5 alliance battle maps. The battlefield map is determined by the location of the border between the two warring nations. The more territory one nation has, the harder the map will be for that nation. Now, to get started in an alliance battle, your guild needs to be allied with either the Luxans or the Kurzaks. This is done by speaking with a Kurzak or Luxan ambassador in either House Zuhelter for Kurzak or Cavalon for Luxan. Then you travel to your guild hall and talk to the Luxan navigator or the Kurzak commandant, depending on which side your guild is affiliated with, and accept the request to fight for their side. You are then teleported to the outpost of the battlefield that represents the current status of the border. Take note also that players allied with the Kurzaks can be invited as guests by a Luxan guild to join their side in the alliance battle, as well as the other way around. There are currently 5 battlefield maps. There's Kainai Canyon, which is considered deep Luxan. There's Etnaren Keys, which is considered shallow Luxan. There's Salt Spray Beach, which is neutral. There's Gren's Frontier, which is shallow Kurzak, and Ancestral Lands, which is deep Kurzak. Players can't choose which map they'll be in. Instead, when they choose to fight in an alliance battle, they are taken to the one that the Kurzak-Luxan border is currently at. If the border has shifted while the player is in battle, they will be transported to the new map once their battle has ended. When forming a party for an alliance battle, you assemble your group of 4. The party leader will press the Enter Battle button and your party will be sent into the alliance battle, provided that there are 12 individuals, which are 3 teams of 4 people, on the other side waiting to enter as well. The game will keep resetting the counter until there is a full team ready on each side, and it's important that players build experience with these battle maps, as a certain level of untold coordination is needed. Team chat in the chat window allows players to chat with all those in the battle from their alliance. Chatting players from another 4-player group will have their names in darker blue and an ally suffix. You cannot chat with only your team in alliance battles. drawing on the map will only be seen by your team of four, though, and not anyone else. To win a battle, the winning side has to accumulate 500 points before the other side. Accumulating points can be done in two ways: either killing members of the opposing faction, which is 1 point per kill, or holding a control point, which, from the start of the match, every 7 seconds, the game checks to see how many control points a side holds. 1 point is added to the side's score for every control point that that side holds when the game checks, which is every 7 seconds. Also, a white towel winning situation is if the entire opposing party leaves. A knockout winning condition is if one side can hold all 7 control points for 60 consecutive seconds. The match will end with a win for the prevailing side in each of these scenarios. For control points, there are usually 7 control points on the map which are captured by having more players and allies in its vicinity than the other team. Depending on the specific battle map, control points will be at equal distances from either side or closer to the side that's losing on the border. By default, a control point will be in neutral status. If the control point has the same number of players from both sides, then it will not start to shift in either direction. If the control point is neutral and one team has more players on it than the other, then it will start to shift in the direction of that team with more players. The speed by which it shifts is dependent on the number of players that team has more than the other team in the vicinity of the control point. For example, if one team has 4 players and the other has 1, then the control point will shift to the team with 4 players with a speed of 3 pips, which is, you know, the difference between 4 and 1. If the control panel is already owned by one side and the other team brings more players to it than those of the team that owns it, then the control point will first shift away from the side that owns it. It'll go down, and then, which the speed again is relative to the difference in presence. And then once the control point has drained away all of its allegiance bar to one side, it'll be announced as neutralized, and then it'll start to shift back towards the other side. So let's say you're Kurzik, and you take over a spot that the Luxans previously had. So the bar will be red. And when you get in there, let's say you have 4 guys, so, and there's nobody else on there, there's no Luxans at all, so it'll start going down. The red bar will actually start going down at a pip rate of 4. Once it gets all the way down, it'll be announced that it's neutralized, and then it'll start turning blue at the same rate of 4, because you have 4 players there, and until it gets all the way to a full bar of blue. The NPCs guarding a control point will count towards the team they belong to when the shift is taking place. Pets, minions, and spirits do not count as allies when affecting the shift. Once captured, a control point will spawn a few NPC guards, which count towards holding the control point, and they offer some other special abilities, like resurrecting allies closer to the battle, or increasing character speed, or elemental protection, or creating NPCs that will actually follow the players around, things like that. The NPC guards do not respawn, except in some cases, such as the Salt Spray Dragon Hatchling, and they only do this unless the point is lost and then recaptured, so it can often be advantageous to kill one, even if it means your character's death. Each kill awards the team's member with 1 faction point and 6 Balthazar faction points. Each kill also adds a point onto your team's score, which at the end is doubled, so you will effectively get 3 Kurzik or Luxan faction points per kill. Both the winning and losing team earn 2 Luxan or Kurzik faction points for each point that they scored in battle, so the winning team receives an additional 250 faction points. You will receive, in total, maximum, 1250 faction points for winning an alliance battle. Now here's some other miscellaneous points to keep in mind for strategy in alliance battles. There's no death penalty during alliance battles, and characters are respawned quickly. This makes minion masters and Ai Wei warriors quite powerful, as there are almost always corpses laying around to use. This lack of death penalty and quick resurrection also means that there's little point in bringing resurrection skills, unless the ally would have to run too far a distance to rejoin the battle, but I would say don't bring a res at all. during these alliance battles. It's also important to spread out and focus on gaining shrines rather than directly fighting the enemy. A clumped up team can't easily capture or defend multiple control points. Sometimes it's worth giving up a control point and then recapturing it in order to respawn the NPC guards also. A tutorial to the current map is offered by an NPC in the outpost, so be sure to read the instructions before forming a group, because they will give you some good pointers. What can we just put
aside all the doubts about music and what has come to be? Hey all, this is Lady Sinea bringing you the word on the street. Did you guys, perchance, hear Kane at the beginning of our last episode? Man, he is so awesome. I wish he were my boyfriend. I hope you guys are all enjoying your holiday and winter's day so far. I want to read to you some emails this week. This first one is from Ikari Kaimaru, and it's about factions. He says, I was going back and listening to the Assassin episode, and I wanted first to say that I agree with almost all your points. As a PvE guy myself, Faction's story was lackluster at best, although I really enjoyed the true ending with the Divine Path that Prophecies lacked. The one point that I did want to mention is that you said how hard it was to be level 16 when you get dropped off on the mainland. Now, at first I told myself the same thing. However, I later found out that there are quick and easy routes that put you through little to no mobs to finish all of the newbie quests. If it felt too hard, that's because you were trying to go through the direct route, which is the wrong route. The reason that all of the henchies are level 20 is for traveling to the endgame areas from there. I hope that makes sense. Thank you for doing a wonderful job on the podcast. Keep up the good work. That may or may not be true. Frankly, I think that at that point of the game, they intend you to be at least close to level 20 and have your additional 30 attribute points. It's true that I did recently take a medium level character through that part of the early mainland region to get to an armor crafter, and it wasn't very difficult, but it was not a flawless victory. My character died a few times along the way, even though I chose a route where there were very few groups and no bosses. So I still stand by what I said about how they intended it to be level 20 play throughout pretty much the entire game. I do agree with what he said about the ending, though. Prophecies didn't really have a proper end to the game the way that Factions in Nightfall do. After the last mission in Tyria, it's kind of like, is that it? Okay, this next email, which was about Nightfall, actually was from the same guy, and he says, I agree that All's Well That Ends Well was amazing, as was the role of a lifetime. While I admit that Nightfall was really difficult, especially for new players, I personally don't agree that the challenge was enough to discredit the game. Personally, I think Nightfall is hands down the greatest campaign yet. As you said, Tyhark Orchard was worth the game alone. As for me, the first time seeing... I'm not going to read this part because it's spoiler, but he said that he really liked part of the plot of the endgame. The story was amazing, you have to admit that. The main reason that I'm writing now is that I'm afraid that what you said in reference to Nightfall on the latest show will discourage new players from playing what I believe to be the greatest Guild Wars yet. I'm sure that if you look deep down, you'll probably agree with me too. Your comments about factions previously were valid as you explained your reasoning thoroughly. This time around with Nightfall, I didn't feel that your rant was as warranted, with the only reasoning being difficulty. Don't forget that your words, as well as Sean's, hold a lot of weight, and that discrediting a game could make or break the addition of new players to the game. Thanks again for a great show. Okay, now, there's a few million Guild Wars boxes out there sold, and less than a few thousand listen to this show, so I can say with some confidence that a large majority of the Guild Wars community is not going to hear what I said, but I do understand what you're saying. I didn't think that people would take what I say into account when making purchasing decisions, but I found out recently that some do. I have an alliance mate who was saying that he didn't know if he should buy Factions or Nightfall first, and one of the factors in his decision was, well, Lady Sinea doesn't like Nightfall. Now, no matter how much I whine and complain about something, by no means am I saying don't buy Nightfall. Just because I've said that I don't like certain things about it does not mean that I regret having bought it. I absolutely love Heroes, And that's part of the game that you just can't get if you don't buy Nightfall. The same goes for factions. There's things about it that I like. Alliance battles, alliances. You can't form alliances without the guild leaders owning factions. So, you know, no matter what I say about not liking one part of the game versus another, it doesn't mean that I'm unhappy with having purchased these games. I am glad that I do own all three chapters, because it means that I have access to the full experience and am not missing out on anything. So yeah, even if I say that I don't like something, that does not mean don't buy the game. If your finances allow it, you should certainly buy all the chapters, because, Guild Wars is cool. So now I've got another email which has the flip side opinion about Nightfall. Critina Starfire says, "Greetings from cold, frosty London. I've been listening to the show for about 6 months now, and I just wanted to say hi and let you know that you're doing a fantastic job. Long may it continue. I've just listened to episode 58, and I have to admit that I agree wholeheartedly with your thoughts regarding Nightfall. I got it on release day and played it for a while, both with new characters and also a few from Prophecies and Factions. When all of us began playing Factions approximately 7 months ago, we all began on Xingjie Island, and as we know, it's a beautiful area for new characters to explore and level up in. I just love those fat yetis. Pre-searing in Prophecies is equally wonderful, but Noob Island in Nightfall, aka Istan, is, for me, just not fun in the way that the other two starter areas are. Latenda Bog is so tedious, and running around in the Mitanni Keys soon begins to get on your nerves. This did not bode well for the rest of the game. If I hated Noob Island, what was the rest going to be like?" Now, I had no problems with Istan, but I probably haven't had the full experience of the island that an Alonian character would have had, because I've never had to level up in that area. I haven't done all of the quests because my Paragon is still very low level, and I probably won't even play him very much. And I've only taken Tyrion characters through that area, so I've never had to do some of that stuff. Oh, which brings me to a point. I am so glad that they changed it so that non-Alonian characters don't have to grind for those stupid Sunspear points anymore. Some people like them, but I think they're totally pointless. Sean may have had fun with it, and it didn't seem as grindy to him because he was liking it, but I didn't care for it at all. So, I'm glad that they removed that so that I don't have to grind for those points anymore on any of my other characters. This email continues, "Fortunately, things improved considerably when I got to go on a little sightseeing trip to Gundara. Consulate Docks is a great mission and a lot of fun, especially if you do what I did the first time I tried it, and only took Susuke, Elias, and Dunkoro because I didn't notice that it was an 8-person party rather than the 4 that you usually have in Kamaden. I hoped and expected that this would be the shape of things to come and carried on into Korna. Once I arrived at Command Post, my hopes of an improvement were fading fast, and by the time I reached Vabi, I had lost the will to live. I just wasn't enjoying it anymore. Playing the other chapters can, at certain times, cause you to become really frustrated or annoyed with Guild Wars. Missions like Thunderhead Keep, Gyala Hatchery, and the Titan missions spring to mind, but I've never actually become bored with Guild Wars. I decided to take a week away from the game to see if I had merely been playing it too much and had lost my hunger for Guild Wars. That plan lasted all of 3 days. I just had to get back to the Jade Sea and protect those cute little baby turtles. So that proved I wasn't bored with the game, just Nightfall. Another 5 days went by, and I decided it was time to give Nightfall another try. I did the missions in Vabi. Getting drunk at the prince's party in Tyhark Orchard was wonderfully cool, although Lumo the Mime drove me up the wall." Dude, that part rules. I just go into that mission and hang out there and play that one part and pwn him over and over again. He says, "After the last visit of the Mad King, I swore I would never use another emote again. So much for that idea." And then he talks about some other stuff about that mission. And he says that there's another part, which is integral to the Gates of Desolation mission. He says that and Tyhark Orchard was the last time I actually enjoyed anything in Nightfall. I grabbed the Fat Mesmer, since I had already had Koss as a warrior hero, and later on I picked up General Turncoat. I then carried on into the Custard Yellow Wasteland, but I couldn't figure out why I was just not enjoying myself the way I do in the other chapters. Most of the visuals are beautiful in Nightfall, but it has neither the frenetic new fight every 5 seconds feel of Kainang, nor the engrossing storyline and large distances between outposts of Prophecies. Prophecies is one extreme and Factions is the other. Nightfall is the middle ground, and it just isn't as interesting. Perhaps you need one of those extremes to make a game distinctive and engrossing. Another thing that annoys me about Nightfall is this daft insignia system for armor. It is just overly complicated when it doesn't need to be. The Prophecies approach, where different armor styles had different stats, was a bit limiting. So in Factions it was changed so that you could buy about 6 different versions of any armor style depending on the stats you wanted. This worked beautifully and did not need changing. So they changed it. I have not bothered adding any insignias to the armor I bought in Nightfall. I disliked the system so much that I salvaged the materials from the armor and went to Voldo the Exotic in Kaining Docks and bought some of his instead. Now there's a guy who knows about giving the customers what they want. ArenaNet also didn't bring back the proper mission and bonus system in Nightfall, which seemed like a no-brainer decision to me. They went for another unsuccessful middle ground solution halfway between the Prophecies and Faction system, and managed to take the worst features of both and upset just about everybody. Look, guys, you've had 3 attempts at this now. You got it right the first time. Stop trying to reinvent the wheel. And that was Nightfall. I thought not liking it was just me being picky, but my guild leader seems to have had an almost identical experience with Nightfall as I did. And as you feel similarly about Nightfall, that makes 3 of us. There must be more players who feel this way, maybe as many as 10. But joking aside, I am hoping the worst mistakes in the game can be changed retrospectively, but my hopes aren't high. ArenaNet's priorities are on Chapter 4 now, so other than a few bug fixes, I cannot see anything changing. From now on, I just go over to Kamada and pick up the heroes there and head back to proper Guild Wars, where I enjoy playing the game. Krytina. Well, Krytina, you put into words a lot of the feelings which I had a couple weeks ago, but I just didn't know how to properly vocalize them. So, in response to Ikari, who was the one who wrote the email about me saying that the whole game was bad just based on difficulty, it really isn't just the difficulty that was annoying to me. There were all these other various points, too. So let me talk about some of these things. Krytina said that he wasn't having fun by the time he got to Vabi. I don't know why, because I really liked that area. The whole place, the gardens and everything are gorgeous. I totally agree about the armor. I think Factions did it right when they did armor. You choose the armor, you choose the stats, and you buy it. In Nightfall, it's not really like the armor is more customizable or anything. It's just one more step that you have to do to add the insignia to it. I went and got my Mesmer's armor, and then I had to buy insignia for it. And I just thought that was completely lame. It's not like it's harder to do, and it's not really very complicated when you look at it, but it was just an added thing which was not necessary. They should definitely take a page from Faction's book and make armor available in that fashion in future chapters. It's interesting that everyone has their own opinion on which chapter they have liked best so far. Some, like Ikari, are saying Nightfall, hands down. Some people, like Lysander, say that they liked Factions the best. And he said that, yes, it's not just because of the Ritualist. He likes the rest of the game, too. And I have a guildie who hates Prophecies, but that one is my personal favorite. So it all just comes down to opinion and personal taste. And you know, it's not just nostalgia on my part, though, when it comes to loving Prophecies. It's not just like, well, that's the game that I fell in love with, and that's why I love Guild Wars so much. Because I fairly recently remade a couple of characters, a week or so ago, I just finished my 7th time through Prophecies. 8th if you count my Ellie, but she's not actually all the way through the game yet. So I've been through these missions a few times. Plus, there's missions that I've done many times over. So, yeah, I've played these a lot, but I'm still not bored with the game yet. And I think that's really saying something for a game to have that much staying power and replayability. Oh, it's been a couple of weeks since I last talked to you, so you don't know what I've been up to. Well, I took my Mesmer, and after I grabbed those heroes from Alona, I went back to Ascalon and started playing through Prophecies, and my heroes leveled up right along with me as I went through the game. Then when I got to about level 16 or so, I went back to Alona and started playing those missions. Burned through all of those, got to the Bone Palace in a couple days, got my armor, bought my stupid insignia, and dyed the armor. I love that dye preview window. And then I went and finished the rest of Prophecies that week. A few people were asking me how I managed to get through the game so fast, but part of it, I'm sure, is that I just know the game really well, so I'm not wandering around and looking for what to do next. But another big part of it is I had level 20 heroes to accompany me through most of the game in areas where the henchmen are all below max level. I just love having heroes in the other chapters. There's no need to be looking for another person to do the mission with you. You just add whatever hero you want, and away you go. Then I also went and got my 30 attribute points. That is pretty much the only major downside I see to having a Tyrion character when you compare it to the stats of a character from one of the other chapters, is you have to be pretty far into the game before you have access to your attribute points. So anyway, now that I've finished all that, now what am I doing? Well, surprise, surprise, I've started playing my Mesmer through factions. Not loving it, of course, nearly as much as I did Prophecies, but I'm still enjoying myself. So, remember that even though I love to complain about the things that I don't like in the game, if you haven't noticed, I haven't stopped playing it. So, just take whatever I say for what it is. You know, there may be some things that I hate, but I'm still as much of a Guild Wars addict as I've always been. There's probably plenty more that I could tell you about, but Menlo and Togo's AI are terrible in factions, and right now they're running into a huge mob, and I have to go save them before those noobs get themselves killed. So until next time, this has been Lady Sinea bringing you the word on the street. Why can't we just
put aside all the doubts about music? So now you know all about the different factions. You know about alliance battles and how they work, but you don't have a good alliance battle build. Well, if you're an elementalist, you're in luck, because I'm going to go over an effective build that's used to cause high damage with semi-spammable AoE pressure that's great for alliance battles. The build is called the Searing Flames Elementalist build, and it's built around the elite spell Searing Flames. Oddly enough, you'll want your attributes concentrated on fire magic as high as you can, including the use of runes, mods, insignias, or whatever you can get to max that attribute out as high as you can. And then just put the rest of your attributes into energy storage, maxing that out as much as you can also. Other spells in this build include Glowing Gaze, Liquid Flame, Glyph of Lesser Energy, Fire Attunement, Glyph of Sacrifice, Meteor Shower, and a Res Sig. I've talked about Meteor Shower, the two glyphs, the Res Sig, and Fire Attunement before, so I'm going to concentrate on the three main spells of this build, and that's Searing Flames, Glowing Gaze, and Liquid Flame. First, let's start with Searing Flames. Target foe and all nearby foes are struck with Searing Flames. Foes already on fire, when this skill is cast, are struck for 7 to 91 fire damage. Foes not already on fire begin burning for 1 to 6 seconds. This Fire Magic Elite spell costs 15 energy, has a 1 second activation time, and a 2 second recharge time. It can be captured from Core Mob Burning Heart in Dasha Vestibule Mission, Kor Living Flame in Torai's Procession, or Korshik the Immolated in the Forum Highlands. Then we have Glowing Gaze. Target foe takes 5 to 41 fire damage. If that foe is on fire, you gain 1 to 7 energy. This spell will be your energy management, along with Fire Attunement and the Glyph of Lesser Energy, which is very important in this spammable build. This fire magic spell costs 5 energy, has a 1 second activation time, and a 5 second recharge time. You can purchase it from Tone in Kamadan. And finally, we have Liquid Flame. Target foe is struck for 7 to 91 fire damage. If that foe is attacking or casting a spell, nearby foes are also struck for 7 to 91 fire damage. This here is your AoE damage spell. It's a fire magic spell that costs 10 energy, has a 1 second activation time, and a 15 second recharge time. You can get it from Resh in Yanr Market, Barum in the Kodesh Bazaar, Keohir in the Command Post, and Roman in Jaqanar Diggings. Now take note that all three of these spells are Nightfall spells, so if you don't have Nightfall yet, you won't be able to get these three spells and do this build. So let's go over how this build actually works. First, you want to keep Fire Attunement up at all times, and then you simply find a mob of players or NPCs, usually around a shrine, and you cast Searing Flames, Glowing Gaze, and Liquid Flame repeatedly. You use Glyph of Lesser Energy whenever possible to assist your energy, and then you cast Meteor Shower on a bunched up group of players or NPCs to basically cause panic. The basic concept of this build is to cause damage to a group huddled together, make them burn, and gain energy from the burning. Rinse, repeat. That's basically it. It's a very simple build once it's been played through a few times, and it works wonders. Just watch out for those pesky mesmers. Why can't we just put aside all the doubts about music and what it's come to? So we come to the close of another Guildcast. This is going to be an extended closing here because I really have a lot to talk about. First off, some news on the guild front. Just before I went on vacation last week, I formed a new guild, which will act as the PvP sister guild for Guildcast Listeners United, which is currently the PvE version. This new long-overdue guild is called the Ramen Empire, in honor of an ongoing joke from within the guild itself, thanks to our favorite voicemail contributor, Mirage. It's a little play on words, you know, with, like, the Roman Empire, and, yeah. Anyway, speaking of Mirage...
Hey, everyone. If you can guess who this is, you will win nothing! Yay! Yeah, it's Mirage calling once again, sending another voicemail again. Critics are better than Luxins, which is the only thing I can think about for the next show. Oh yeah, happy Winter's Day, finals suck, and ramen will pwn your souls.
But anyway, it'll be a PvP-only guild, still represented by Guildcast, which means it will also fall under the Guild and Alliance's rules. It will be exclusively GVG or Heroes Ascent, and, you know, with the occasional Alliance battles thrown in, or any other kind of PvP that the guild decides to do. That's all fine. If you'd like to be a part of this brand new guild, then check out the section on the Guildcast forums dedicated to this guild. And there's a join request board on there that you can actually post to. Now, I will not be running this guild myself, so keep that in mind. It'll be under the supervision of a few officers, mainly Balsam Forever, who is expertly trained by the guys over at Wave, like the Shadowed Blade and the Shining Shield. So I really, really appreciate all the help that they've given. Now, since this is the first official announcement of the guild, expect more to come in the future regarding scheduled GVG times and more officers to contact, things like that. My ultimate goal for this guild, though, is to see it either have a high ladder placement or possibly, you know, see its name up as winning halls often, you know, things like that. I'd really like to get it up there as a fan site guild. Okay, so now that that's out of the way, on to my second announcement. As most of you know, I took a break last week from the show to visit family in Chicago, right? Well, it was not only a nice break from work and everything else in my life, but it was also a time to reflect on the future of this podcast. Now, I've been doing the show for over a year now, every week, just about, either in writing, recording, and editing the show, or just editing the shows whenever Lady Sinea has taken over. I probably spend about 10 to 15 hours a week doing the show, and this includes time at my job, where I usually write and research each episode. This not only takes time away from my actual workload and productivity at my job, but it also takes away from my other hobbies, and my other projects, and most regrettably, my family time. As some of you may or may not know, I've been divorced for about 3 years now, so the weekends are the only time I get to see my daughters. The rest of the week after work is mine and mine alone, so that's precisely how I can even do this podcast while juggling so many other things. When I first started the podcast, that was my biggest thing. You know, I have all this time to myself, and this is how I want to spend it. But now, it's really exploded into something that I could never have imagined, and it takes up more time than I have available. So here's the deal. Okay, I'm not stopping the podcast, but I am going to do it less frequently. Having a self-imposed deadline of every week is just not working anymore for me. I've been thinking about this for a long time, and I've discussed it in depth with Lady Sinea as well. Now, I'll admit, I wanted to stop everything completely. The thought of not having any responsibility towards something that I actually pay to do seemed like such a great idea, you know? I could have all this time back. But then we talked about it, and we thought about maybe just doing it whenever we can. Like, you know, get together every once in a while and just do a Skype show. No more of these heavy information shows, you know, that I do a lot. Well, I really like the sound of that, you know. So I thought about it more over my break. But then, you know, to be perfectly honest, I really missed not doing a show last week. So many things happened that I wanted to talk about. And I'm on vacation and I still can't stay away from the forums, from the Guild Wars forums, and from my own forums. You know, I'm going through and I'm reading this stuff, and I'm learning about all these new updates, and it's just kind of driving me nuts, you know. I'm not sure if I've just accustomed myself to this podcast's schedule, or if it's just that I really honestly enjoy doing the show that much. But whatever it is, I just can't let it all go yet. So as of right now, here's what I've decided. I'm going to do the podcast every other week instead of every week, starting with episode 62. So since this is episode 59, we still got a couple more consecutive weeks left before I actually start doing it every other week. I'm also going to no longer say that it will be released only on the weekend, because that just really isn't working for me either. So the show may come out on a Saturday, or it may come out on a Tuesday, or whatever. I'm not going to stress out on deadlines anymore, because, well, it's just silly to bust my butt for a deadline that I've created myself. Also, I'd really, really like to play Guild Wars again. It's getting to the point where, ironically, I can't play the game anymore because I'm doing a podcast about the game. Well, the funniest part about this whole thing is, knowing me, I probably won't really spend any less time on the podcast and the website at all. I have all these ideas floating around in my head for, you know, website upgrades, in-game upgrades, like this new PvP guild that I've just started, for example, and just a whole series of new things that I'd like to do with the website and the podcast, including, you know, that Guildcast Theater video that I did a few months ago. I called that episode 1 because I actually have been working on more, and I have 5 more episodes written, and they're in the recording stages now. One of them is actually in the editing stage, almost done. So, you know, I guess my point is, I'm not going away. I'm not pod fading. I'm simply varying my Guild Wars and Guild Cast time, spreading it across many projects instead of just trying to go full force on all projects all the time. You know, one person can't do that. I mean, I know Lady Sinea helps out too, and there's help with the guild and with the forums and everything like that, but it's just getting to the point where I don't want to burn myself out on this because I really enjoy doing it. And hopefully, by doing it every other week like this, it'll help. And hopefully you all understand, you know, the whole situation. And you understand that this isn't a way for me to try to get out of doing the podcast or break away from it, because Guild Wars is just really growing by leaps and bounds every day. And, you know, with every new chapter, they outdo themselves. They're, you know, they just reached 3 million users, or 3 million boxes sold, basically. And it's just a thing that's building and building and building. And I would be an idiot to just quit now and get out now. I really like where the podcast is going. I really like where, you know, where ArenaNet is going with Guild Wars. And I don't want to lose that. But I just do want to keep myself from burning out, like I said. And I just want to, you know, kind of do it a little less frequently. And honestly, who knows? This might just be a temporary thing. I might drive myself absolutely insane waiting an extra week between episodes, and I might start releasing them every week again. You just never know. So anyway, for my third announcement. For next week's episode, which will be next week, in fact, I want to do something special that's been suggested by a few people in the forums, including Muffin Man and a few other people. And that's a Skype call-in show like we did a few months ago, but this time I want people to call in with their New Year's wish list of what they want to see in the future of Guild Wars. Not only in Chapter 4, but just beyond that. I'm hoping to make it something that ArenaNet can listen to for future ideas. I know I have my own wish list, so this should be an exciting show. We'll be doing this on Friday, December 29th at 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. It'll be the first time I've tried this on the show, although I did test it a few times, but I'll be trying out this new Skype casting that was recently introduced. So what you'll need is to upgrade your Skype to at least 2.5, but 3.0 will actually work the best. That's the newest version. And you'll need the link for this particular Skype cast room that we'll be using. I guess they call them rooms. I have this room already set up, and no one can join it until the actual starting date, you know, Friday, December 29th at 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. But while we're there recording, people will actually be able to connect to the room and listen in to the show live, up to 100 people maximum. So it'll actually act as, you know, a live show. From within the Skype cast, I can grant people voice access, almost like, you know, like passing the mic around to people for when they have questions. It could be one person or it could be several people that I could grant this access to. But here's the best thing. If you want to talk, if you have a question, or in the case of next week, if you want to talk about your wish list, you simply click on a menu button on the interface that will say something like request to talk, I think is what it says, which will put you in a waiting list of sorts to get on and talk. This will work so much better than last time, where people PM'd me requesting to come on, and I had to try to keep track of who was first, and I had all these PM windows opening up, and it was crazy. It was really hard to keep track of. So this should really be a lot better, a lot more organized, and it really should be a lot of fun. I'm really looking forward to this. Anyway, I will put up a link in the show notes for more info on Skype casts, and also the link that you'll need to find the particular room that we'll be using when that time comes on next Friday. This link is your ticket to get in, since it will not be a public event listed in the Skype cast directory. So go to www.guildcast.com, and in the show notes for today's episode, number 59, right at the top, you'll find everything you need. What I'll also do for this show is allow people who won't be able to make it for this time to send in a voice clip of their own wish list, or they can call in and leave a voicemail at either my Skype name or on our voicemail line, which is 1-206-666-GWEN, or 4936. Also, if you'd like, you can simply email me your own wish list in text form, and I can read it on the show, along with your character name also. I have a feeling that we'll easily be able to fill up an hour-long show or more with these wish lists, because it's really becoming a pretty popular thing, especially in the forums. We have a whole thread, a multi-page thread, dedicated to what people want to see in the future of Guild Wars. And then the following week after that will be our normal Skype email show with me and Lady Sinea. I actually have a ton of emails this month, so expect a pretty nice-sized show. I still have plenty of ideas for future shows also, so don't worry about that. I'd like to eventually do a Dervish show, of course. A show on the Elite missions, like especially Domain of Anguish. And I'd like to do a roundtable show where a few players can get on Skype, or maybe we'll do it on TeamSpeak, I don't know. And we'll just, you know, bust through a mission together, and possibly, if I can, we'll record the video of the mission on Fraps, and I'll put that together with the audio, and then, you know, release that as kind of a video podcast. So I have those ideas, and I have some others as well, all kind of in the works. So get your wish lists ready for that show next week, and of course, be sure to tell your friends and tell your guildmates about guildcast.com.
Said our hero to Captain Callahan, "Do you see what I see? Charmast up the northern wall. Do you see what I see? Bonfires burned fair, rallying his troops, they will storm us before the night is through. They will storm us before the night is through." Said Errol to the Prince of Ascalon, "Do you hear what I hear? A mighty legendary horn. Do you hear what I hear? It's storm color holding back the peace. This may be the advantage we need. This may be the advantage we need." Said Prince Rurik to his stubborn dad, "Do you know what I know? We could not stop the fall of Rin. Do you know what I know? If we travel west, there may yet be hope. It's the only way we'll save our home. It's the only way we'll save our homes." Said King Adelban to his only son, "I know more than you know. The guild wars are in recent memory. I know more than you know. Our pride forbids us to ask for assistance. We will never crawl to the Crichtons. We will never crawl to the Crichtons." Said a hero to his outcast prince, "I will go where you go. The world we knew will never be the same. I will go where you go. We're still loyal. We follow the crown.